So today's call is regarding a recent discussion forum thread asking for feedback on provider incentive program design, specifically what HCC metrics plans are using, like recapture rate, and how plans are incentivizing providers to close star rating and other care gaps. So Jessica did let us know that she is on the line today. Initially, Jessica kicked off this question on the discussion forum. So if you guys have any questions for her regarding her question, she is here to answer those questions. And I do have Kevin with Paramount is going to kick off today's discussion with his feedback regarding this question. So Kevin, are you still there?
So basically there are four kind of things that we struggle to wrap our heads around. And the first is kind of dealing with the recapture rate of chronic conditions. So if a member has it in 2016, you know, if you're trying to establish incentives for a provider, I mean, saying that the member must have it in 2017 isn't necessarily expecting the condition to be there the next year and giving the provider an incentive based upon that, we kind of struggle with doing that. The second is if we're comparing provider to provider, I mean, you're making the assumption that all providers have all the same members and all the same members have the same conditions. So we kind of struggle with, you know, kind of the case mix between providers. Another issue that we struggle with or are kind of looking at is, you know, are you looking at a holistic view of the member for the year? So diabetes, for example, is the member has diabetes in 2016. So do you then expect the same provider to close the same condition in 2017, or do you just look at it and say, yes, this condition occurred at some point in time, you know, was coded at some point in time during the year. And the last thing, or the fourth that we're looking at is kind of what is our data source? So are we looking at RAPS files from CMS? Are we looking at our claims system? Are we looking at provider feedback? And we're just trying to figure out kind of what our source of truth is going to be when we, you know, if we look at incentives for providers. So those are the four things that we're looking at right now. And I was just curious if anybody in the Alliance had any, you know, expertise or knowledge or opinions or thoughts about any of those four.
That's great, Kevin. All right, I'm going to take everybody off mute now. There's a good chance that there are people who have joined the call who maybe haven't had a chance to mute their lines, so it might be a little bit noisy at first, but we'll try to get everybody to mute their lines, and then people can just speak up and chime in with regards to what Kevin just shared. So just a reminder, if you, while you're not talking, if you could please make sure that your phone is muted, and you can also mute your line using *6. All right.
This is Jessica. I'm going to try to be kind of loud. Let me get one on mute now. Kevin, just wanted to thank you for that. Those are the same struggles that I'm having, which is basically why I started this thread. You know, just throwing around the ideas of, you know, trying to make it fair between the different providers, you know, and do you include new members or only community members? Or do you look at risk scores or do you look at HCC recapture rates? You know, we did a deep dive into our non-recaptured codes reporting that we have. And, you know, out of those, a good portion of them are resolved conditions. You know, they no longer have a BMI greater than 40, so it's not an HCC 22 anymore. You know, things like that. And so just wanted to second that. The things that you named are the same challenges that I'm having as well. I was looking for feedback on.
This is Daniel from Cox Health Plan. One thing I noted on the recapture rate of chronic conditions, that's an obvious one for us as well that we struggle with. On top of that, what we tend to see is especially evident in the RADVs that we just completed. We see a lot of chronic conditions that were coded in previous years that weren't truly chronic conditions. They were miscoded. And so we're struggling with filtering out a lot of the quote-unquote false chronic conditions from the previous year. And so we have to sort of eliminate those before we start really looking at the recapture rate, because a lot of it's, I say a lot of it, there's a percentage of it that's really false. So, for example, somebody may have coded diabetes in the previous year in 2015, and so we're chasing that down for 2016, and it's just a bad diagnosis to begin with. So we have to filter those out, and I don't think it's equal across the board. I think there's some providers that are their numbers are a little bit higher than others in that area, but that's something that we have to consider on our end, and I don't know if that's getting other people as well. But one thing that I didn't hear noted, which we struggle with, is not so much the recapture of chronic conditions, but chasing newly suspected or suspected conditions, as evidenced by medications and that sort of thing. So that's something that we're trying to wrap our head around and incentivize or pay our providers a little differently to make sure we capture those. As far as the chronic conditions and the recapture, we always have that ability on the supplemental file review in addition to secondary diagnoses to capture those. We're really concerned about the ones that aren't being documented at all. For what it's worth, this is my two cents, and I agree with the other three.
Let me know what
comparing providers and holding them responsible, comparing them to one another. I think as long as you're comparing within the same specialty class, so internal med against internal med, or endocrinologist versus endocrinologist, you're fine. That'll help account for patient mix.
And then,
this is Daniel from Cox Health Plans. Just to summarize real quick, we agree with the 4 points. I would say on the first point regarding the recapture rate of chronic conditions, one thing that we've seen struggling with that, a little deeper dive on it, is falsely coded chronic conditions from the previous year. And so we're chasing a false chronic condition to recapture. That kind of skews things. We've actually seen that a fair amount of time. We haven't documented exactly what percentage of those are, but for example, we might be chasing someone to recapture diabetes, and the diabetes was only ever coded on one claim, and it was a false claim. And so we struggle with that. That kind of hampers the incentive piece for the provider if they're not recapturing something that really isn't there, right? So it gives a false notion of what their potential is for recapture. And so we hear back from the providers that, you know, I'm falling short, but Dr. X coded diabetes, and this person doesn't have diabetes, so they're getting quote-unquote dinged for not recapturing that. So that's the difficulty in factoring all that in. Perhaps trying to screen those or remove those from the end before you begin the scoring for the provider is one way. But again, that's pretty labor intensive. Going into the comparison with difference in patient panels, I think if you compare provider specialty type against one another and benchmark against one another, you probably eliminate some of that panel confusion. For example, comparing endocrinology to endocrinology and internal med to internal med and that sort of thing. It's not perfect, but when we look at our providers, we do try and take into consideration specialty type to eliminate some of that panel mix or patient mix. And then holding the original provider responsible, I think that was your third point, or at least that's what I jotted down. It's very hard because we're just trying to take credit where we can from any doctor that codes, a condition, and it's not always the original provider that we're asking to re-document that. Sometimes it could be one of their partners, and they just saw them when they were out of the office once. Sometimes it could be members jumping around PCPs. So that's always difficult. We don't always hold it to the original provider, especially if there's a specialist involved. But certainly a challenge. I don't think there's a perfect answer for that. And I don't really have any thoughts on the data source. That's just summarizing what I said.
Hi, this is Rick Ellison from SumaCare. The question I have for you guys on this is, when you do retrospective chart review and you do find that, a member has certain conditions and they're documented well enough in the chart, and so you code those to get, as a supplemental RAPS file, how do you go back to that provider then and start getting them not only to document it in the medical chart, but to get it in the claim that may come through in order for it to be registered?
Again, I think that's just the very challenge that everyone's dealing with. I mean, when we engage a provider, so we have the ear of a few key physicians in a large physician group, and we're just breaking the surface on this way to pay providers differently to get them to chart differently and so forth. They do all of their own coding. And the struggle they have with is, they have their go-to codes that they use. And educating them on which are good codes or scorable codes, if you will, versus what they're using today is one avenue. We've created a quote-unquote cheat sheet for them that gives them, five or ten of the options of scorable diagnoses that are reasonable to code on their claims. So it's a slow, insidious process, but that's just one way we've talked to them is that the coding is just as important, if not, it's just as important as the documentation itself. And what we've tried to stress with them is that if you do all of the documentation perfect and don't code it with one of these scorable codes, all of the efforts are for naught, and all that time and effort will have been wasted. So we just really try and drive that point home. Unfortunately, it's so early, we don't have any evidence of improvement on that, but I think it's going to be years before we see a measurable improvement in that area.
This is Steve Adams. I'm with SumaCare. Is anybody incenting coding itself or documentation? We often talk about incenting outcomes. Should we be thinking about maybe incenting coding and documentation instead or in addition to? Is anyone doing that?
I kind of view those as the same thing. I mean, if you're obtaining the outcome, they're documenting and coding appropriately.
This is Mitchell with Select Health. We've actually had a problem with that specifically. Supposedly our compliance teams have basically told us that we can't incentivize the way that they code or document. So what we've been doing instead is we give them a form, and we, in order to take care of this resolved condition issue, we've basically been giving them a form and saying, do you agree with this chronic condition? Do you think it's resolved? Or do you disagree entirely that they've never had it? Some of the issues with that we've been having has kind of been stated already is not everyone agrees. Certain times they say, oh, this person's never had this condition, and then another doctor goes and diagnoses it within the same year. Other cases they agree with it, but then they don't put it on the medical record, and so we're not actually recapturing those, even though they're saying that they have the condition. And so I guess the biggest issue kind of going along with this, how are you, basically, how are people incentivizing their providers to document? Because that's been our biggest issue, is we've been trying to give doctors the ability to resolve these conditions and say, oh, yeah, this is not correct or this is correct. But then we've been finding discrepancies, whether it be one doctor's not agreeing with another doctor, or they say that it's there, but then they're not sending in a claim properly for it, and different things like that.
This is Kevin from Paramount again, and I do have a circling back to what Daniel was talking about. Daniel, do you guys have, at Cox, do you have someone on your, like, is it a risk adjustment team member or, like, a quality team member that just focuses on, like, the piece that you were talking about as far as, you know, going out to provider offices and speaking with them and, you know, providing the cheat sheets? Or is that, like, where is that person housed, or how do you do that?
So I'll try and condense this a little bit. The system has a care management team that we have engaged and worked with. We at the health plan house the risk adjustment in our medical department, and that team is really one person. Her name's Michelle. She's sitting right here. She's our risk adjustment coordinator, but her and I have a tandem approach to it, and our CEO, Matt Hogg, is very involved. We've gone and sat face-to-face with them and talked about the issues that are commercial risk adjustment. The biggest eye-opener to begin was that they didn't even know commercial risk adjustment existed. They thought it was just Medicare, and so they were really just focusing on Medicare folks and carving that out. So when we got their ear and started telling them about the money that's being transferred out of the system, they perked up a little bit. And so we just started engaging them, educating them. The main focus was really just getting the people into the office that we know have potential for risk or have had conditions coded in the past. And we just emphasized that once you do get them in, we'll incentivize you for that, getting them in. But when you get them in, please make sure and have thorough documentation. And by the way, here's a cheat sheet of codes that may be applicable. Obviously, we can't tell them how to code, but we can certainly educate them and provide them resources to help them code the best for that patient. And so the incentive really just lies in getting them in the office, and that just comes in the form of, an enhanced E&M code, or, we could reconcile that at the year end, however they want to do that best. But to answer your question, it's really in our medical department. It's one person along with the assistant and myself, and then a little heavy hitter with the CEO at our side. Did that answer it?
Yeah, and I guess you could talk on it too. I mean, I'm assuming your members go to providers that aren't a part of your health plan. So I guess, how do you get, like, the same level of interaction with providers that are in different groups?
Yeah, I should caveat it by saying that we're really only looking at our integrated side. About 60% of our claims hit our provider-owned side. So we have direct line of sight with them. We figure if there is any low-hanging fruit, that's where we haven't even tried engaging the other 40%.
Hi, good morning. This is Pam.
The other 40% typically go to facilities, typically seen inpatient, and our experience has been those inpatient records are pretty thorough and tend to obtain the most the best documentation already. So.
Hi, this is Pam from Presbyterian. We started a pilot program last year, and we have our own medical group at Presbyterian, but we're not doing it with our medical group. We're doing it with our PPO and POS providers, or our network providers. And what we've done is we've gone out and well, we put the program together. We've gone out, reached out to the providers, ran out to their office, which is myself. I'm the program manager in the risk adjustment department. So it's myself. We're a two-man team, actually three-man team. Myself, my coding manager, risk adjustment coding manager, and we've also included one of our medical directors from the health plan. So we go out, we talk about the program, we get them to sign on to it, and what we do is we provide them with a list of their members that belong to Presbyterian that are on the Medicare plan. And we say, hey, if you bring in these members, we provide them with a member information profile, which consists of the members' claims that Presbyterian has received from anyone who submitted a claim on the member into Presbyterian. All those claims are on that member information profile. We kind of have that same thing as I think one of the other plans had. I don't know if it was Rick or Manuel, but it on the member information profile, it has all the conditions, and then it has their agree. I can't remember, I don't have it in front of me, but kind of like that. If the provider agrees that, yes, they have that condition, then they need to mark that column. We expect to see documentation on that condition, and we expect to see it coded and billed on the claim. So what we do is when they are done seeing the member, and usually by quarter, they'll give us, they'll send in all of the records. We don't ask them to do these with or these health assessments on any specific form. We decided that would probably not be a winner because if every health plan was asking them to fill out their own form, they're most likely going to turn us down. So we just said, give us your medical record, date of service you saw the patient, and return the member information profile with that. So when we get that back, our claims or our coding manager takes that medical record, the member profile, and she reviews the claim for that date of service. She goes through the record to make sure that anything that was billed is documented. And then anything that is documented but not billed, we can also use that. And then what we do is we pay based on documentation. So we give them kind of like a report card. So at the end of the quarter, we'll review all those records. We'll go back to their office, provide any education and training we need to provide. But based on what we came out with, let's say we had to remove some of those codes that they had sent in previously for that date of service because there was no documentation to support it. That scored whether or not we added codes because there was documentation. That is scored. And so we give them a passing kind of grade, like 98% accuracy, and then we pay based on their accuracy. We also, like I said, provide training and training and education. You know, we go back and say, hey, out of all these records, you documented, but you didn't add the code, and vice versa, if you know you added this code, but there was no documentation to support it. And so far, it's worked pretty well with the couple providers that have agreed to join the pilot. So whether or not we're going to take that model forward, not sure. We also, and I think Jessica spoke about that, is when Kevin mentioned the things that they were looking at, those were some of our options, too. So we have several options, the pros and the cons of all of them. But we all seem to be on the same page with the options. But for one that I didn't hear, and but just paying based on G-code bills, which, it does promote the visit by the PCP. It encourages them to code the chronic condition, and they can address STARS at that point and HEDIS measures. The cons for that G-code capture is there's no direct incentive to address the HCCs. I mean, they don't have to. They can just go in there and right, do the wellness visit and et cetera, and COVID G-code. It's kind of expensive, and there's not really a return on investment, and it kind of sets the bar for future incentives, which probably isn't a good idea. But that was one of the options that we wanted to rule out using. On the recaptured, we also agree that there is that chance of false, false recapture code. So we would probably take into consideration paying incentives based on a percentage tier, 65, 75, 85, et cetera, percent, because we know that some of those codes aren't really, like someone said, they're either they were miscoded or they're no longer an acute chronic condition. In a plan or in a group that I worked with before, we did it by RAS score, and this was just with our provider group. And as somebody mentioned before, that was, well, I'm a family practice doc, and my folks aren't nearly as sick as my partner down the hall who's an internist, so that's really not fair. So we came up with an age-adjusted and gender-adjusted RAS score. How that came about, I wasn't privy to, but it seemed to work. The providers were happy with it. And if I can get more information on that, I'd be happy to let the Healthline Alliance know and share that with others. But for right now, I just know it worked. I just don't know how it worked. That's all I got.
This is Jean. I'm calling from Paramount along with Kevin. I'm listening to this, and one of the thoughts that's going through my head is, all of us are looking at different options, and yet there's, some of us may cross providers, and there's the potential for what's the best method, because the docs may hear multiple different scenarios based on the different plans and what they think is the best option. So I'm just listening that if I was a provider saying, well, this plan's telling me, go this way, or this is the best way, and this plan's suggesting this. And I know we're giving lists of members, but on the thought that they're not going to always know which member is from which plan, there's the potential for, I don't want to say confusion, because it's going to probably benefit regardless which way they go, but I'm just thinking of potential mixed messages that the providers may be hearing based on the different plans and their best practice thoughts.
This is Daniel. I'm with Sentara Quality Care Network. I just have a question for the group in terms of, is anyone doing a prospective chart review?
This is Mitchell with Select Health. We haven't done it yet, but we are considering to start doing that in order to help. One of the biggest issues is, because we have, like someone mentioned before, it's not just Medicare. You have, the ACA, which is, there's tons of records to review. So it's trying to figure out a way to, what records do you review? Do you just write, the one lady said, reviewing the medical records for the form, to, not their forms, but what they agreed, disagreed, or do you, sit down and have some sort of program that says, okay, or predictive analysis that says, okay, these are the records we want to check. That's always been, we've been trying to figure out what the best method of that is, and maybe some group has some thoughts on how they do that. That's always good as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Janice also commented through the chat that First Care is considering doing prospective chart review as well. This is Nicole with the Alliance.
You see, that's kind of the boat I'm in. We're dealing with a very small population at this point, but that's what I have personally started to do. I've moved over from case management to combining some coding, a little bit of coding too, and have now moved into this assignment of doing some prospective review where we look for those who have, you know, upcoming appointments, and we send queries to the physicians that remind them, look, this was an accepted HCC diagnosis last year. It's not been documented on this year. I see evidence of a, you know, a condition that you've not diagnosed before, you know, kind of coded or inferred based on medication or what have you. And we just ask some questions of them, very brief. And, of course, on our, you know, the provider, the owned providers, those that are, you know, within our system using the same EMR, it's easy. We actually fire an alert to them when they open that session with their patient, and it pops up that, by the way, you didn't document this year that that this patient has a below the knee amputation. Please put that in your assessment and plan.
Yep, that's really good feedback. And is anybody else on the call today doing something similar or is taking another approach to prospective reviews?
Trey Rawls. I'm a consultant with Adventist Health System in Florida. One of the things that we've done on the prospective side, kind of like some others, just using a patient-specific form, and this goes back to kind of the metric that we use. I remember one of the four issues at the beginning of the call was do we do an analysis on reconfirmation rates kind of at the whole patient level, or do we look at a visit level? The way that we've done it in the past, and we found some success, is basically we know what conditions are on the patient-specific form that we implement using a very prospective process. So we make sure that we hardwire a process where all the providers get the forms at the point of care, and then we know what comes, the information that comes back on the claims, and we also know that there's some bad data in there. So to some degree, some of the stuff resolves, some of the stuff it was improperly coded previously. But we've set up basically an analytic system that at a visit level, we just compare for PCPs, and we have an incentive link to the piece of paper, but as an attestation that they got the piece of paper and they did a comprehensive coding visit using the piece of paper. We just look at averages, and we say, okay, if the medical group on average is reconfirming the top 10 chronic HCCs during the visit at a 70% reconfirmation rate, we will look for the providers that are at a 35% reconfirmation rate or at an HCC level. If I continually prompt Dr. Smith to code morbid obesity, and he's 0 for 20 on morbid obesity, we'll go have a conversation with him about that. So it's a little bit different from the audit perspective. We have a separate audit process where if providers are overcoding or undercoding, it's a separate process. But we also have an education process that's very focused on just hardwiring a visit, getting the right data to the provider at the point of care, and then monitoring the ones who are consistently below the average.
Thank you. That's helpful.
This is Nicole with the Alliance. We're starting to get a little bit more feedback on the line again, so I just want to take a minute to remind everybody that if you're dialed into today's call, then mute your line when you're not speaking. You can also mute your line using *6 and unmute using *7. And then if you are joining today's call through your laptop speakers, you will also want to mute your computer or laptop mic. That'll pick up your audio as well. So if you're using your computer, mute your mic.
This is Trey one more time. So the visit level reconfirmation rate we found good for just monitoring who has or hasn't hardwired the process that we're asking for. But just on an overall, if we're trying to measure the performance of one CIN versus another CIN, or something like that at a higher summary level, we really, rather than looking at average RAS score trends, because obviously there's differences in disease burden, one of the things that we've tried to look at is just MLR, because if a RAS score is what it's supposed to be, predictive of future cost, then we want to actually, so if one population is sicker than another, we would expect it to also have a higher cost than another and a higher RAS score than another. So we'll look at cost as a factor as well as the RAS score. And if a population has rising costs but not a rising RAS score, that's one of the indicators that we'll look at as far as just overall summary performance.
Hi, this is Rick Ellicson again from SumaCare. We do a lot of risk mitigation on our providers besides doing, you know, revenue recovery. And so when you go to incentivize providers, what do you do for those providers that are consistently coding like cancers when it's a history of or some type of acute condition, you know, and it's just, you know, they have heart attacks and, you know, and they just, we can, you know, recode these year after year. How do people handle that?
So Janice with First Care sent me a message through the chat that said that their most common issue that they're finding is that providers are listing diagnoses but not actually treating the patient for the diagnosis. So a little bit different take on that question that you just posed, but also another issue that I think kind of in a similar bucket requires provider education. So does anybody have any feedback on how they're educating providers around specifically how you as a plan need them to code those diagnoses to capture more accurate HCC codes?
I don't really have feedback exactly on that. This is Jessica again. But one of the things that I'm thinking about or coming across with this as well is that if you start going to a provider one by one and reviewing all of their charts, you're going to end up deleting a lot of codes. And so I worry about this a little bit because I'm like, we need to provide the training. We need the charts to be accurate. But we're also probably in the short term going to be reducing our risk scores because we're going to have to train them on documenting better. So I was just curious if anybody has experienced that besides us or that you're actually deleting more than you're adding when you start this kind of program. And is it really the right thing to review 100% of their charts, or should we just be reviewing a sample, or should we be, you know, giving them just a list of, like, the top five things that kind of seems like everybody's doing wrong, or just if anybody had any thoughts on that by chance.
This is Dean from Optima Health. Just a quick response to that last point. In both my work with the ACA RADV, ACA record retrieval, and previous work at Humana, I have always found that the codes that exist in the charts exceed the codes that exist in the claims. If you're handpicking certain charts corresponding with certain claims, then you may be more likely to find more deletes than adds. But overall, if you are getting every single chart, I would say, with rare exception, you're going to find more adds than deletes.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, this is Brett Senor with Mission. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead, Brett.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'm a provider, and I'm also a physician advisor to the CDI staff. And the point that was just raised, yeah, I think that really by picking like either top five or top ten list for those conditions by specialty is a very reasonable approach to, you know, expect providers just to get them all right out of the box is an impossibility at this point in time. So that's point number one. Another point that I wanted to raise is that in talking with a person who had been a RADV auditor before, she had raised a concern about just focusing on diagnoses that are HCC conditions, and that really, and I would have to say I agree with this, we have to really educate providers to capture conditions that are clinically relevant, and that way, you know, as audits happen, as RADV auditors do reviews, they're not seeing purely HCCs every time, number one. And number two, it's just better patient care to really capture all conditions, whether they're HCC eligible or not, to help to describe these patients. So I just wanted to bring that up, that caution, as far as how to roll out education to your providers. And one last point, regarding the issue of commercial payers versus CMS, maybe using, you know, asking for different ways of capturing diagnoses. One thing that we found effective is to train providers to document with the specificity necessary across the board, because it should be pretty similar. And that is even on the inpatient side for DRGs. We actually ask providers to capture specificity that would be consistently captured for DRGs versus HCCs, and whether that's CMS or HHS. So while that degree of specificity is oftentimes not necessary for CMS HCCs, for instance, I think it's just a good practice, because then they hear the same message consistently. And consistency with providers goes a long way.
Thank you for that.
So this is Nicole with the Alliance. Danielle from First Care sent me a message through the chat letting me know that they do delete diagnosis codes that they can't confirm once the medical record review is completed. The RADV audit is, they use the RADV audit as a tool to help providers understand how to code and document treatment of that diagnosis during the visit. And then they also work with their special investigation unit. And they partner with them on chart review activities. This is Nicole with the Alliance. It sounds like we're picking up some background noise, so I'm just going to, again, remind everybody on the line that if you're not contributing in today's discussion, just go ahead and mute your telephone line or mute your laptop if you've connected through your laptop. And you can also mute using a touchpad. And to do that, you just need to press star 6 to mute and star 7 to unmute.
Thank you.
All right. It looks like I was able to get the background noise muted. Does anybody else have anything else to add with regards to provider incentive programs?
I guess I have one last question. To expand on what Pam was talking about with the G codes, for that one, like, does anybody do that, just really incentivize based on the visit and not actually look at the HTCs or the recapture rate, but just on the visit itself? And is that effective at all, or is that really just not effective?
This is Mitchell with Select Health. We used to do that, and in some cases, depending on the provider, it was effective. The problem that we ran into is some doctors wouldn't use the full visit. So supposedly with an annual wellness visit, we're hoping that they do a 45-minute visit, but instead they do a 15-minute visit and not diagnose all the HECs. They just go through everything quickly and just say, okay, everything's good. And so the issue comes down to is having a little bit of training with that sometimes is a little more effective, or if a doctor has some time to do it, but it's kind of a crapshoot almost sometimes when you're going through that and saying, oh yeah, this provider did well and this is where it was, and this provider just kind of flew through things.
Gotcha. Thank you.
This is Dean from Optima Health. I have the perspective from the plan or the payer. And when thinking about a provider incentive program, I really don't have the perspective from the other side. And I heard one individual talk earlier who was a provider, and I wondered if he or perhaps some others that have talked directly with the providers have any insights when you just ask the provider, hey, you know that additional coding and documentation increases revenue for the plan. What kind of incentive would you like that benefits us both as payer and provider? And what kind of metrics should we use to determine the amount of that incentive?
This is Jean from Paramount. I was actually thinking the same thing. If there have been any physician or provider focus groups that anyone has put together or in any which way gotten some information from. And then the other, and this just as an aside, is that I was talking to our manager of provider relations, and he made mention that next year's Ohio State Medical Association, they are asking plans to actually it's as a part of presentations, coding has to be in. So I think at the high level, the coding aspects is slowly becoming top down from the medical associations, at least from the information I've heard at this point. So I wanted to throw that out too.
Hey everyone, this is Tim Poulton. I just joined in on the call here a little while ago. I'm a family medicine doctor in Aspen, North Carolina, so I can my limited perspective. A couple quick thoughts that jump to mind. For us, at least all of my colleagues are employed by the health system. So those types of conversations on, you know, hey, this is relevant, how would you like it to be structured, they certainly don't happen, and I'm not sure feasibly how they could. We just tend to find out, hey, this is your compensation, but there's certainly someone within the system who's having those conversations. But I think also just stresses the importance of communication. You know, like for me, if I were to get a sheet ahead of time on, you know, charges that had been captured previously in this, there's some that weren't relevant that someone else had done improperly, that's not going to bother me. But I'm, you know, sort of a biased person being invested in this work. But I think if we can communicate effectively throughout the system to folks, they'll be much more receptive to it. So it just doesn't seem like something that's sort of dictated from the top down. If they understand the relevance, the quality of care, and, you know, the benefits to the much more receptive however the compensation part of it is rolled out. And that was all.
This is Kevin from Paramount. I was just kind of listening to everybody talk, and kind of a different approach that I was just kind of thinking about in my head. I don't know, has anybody tried using, like, the retrospective chart reviews to establish, like, a provider incentive? And by that I mean, say, provider group X. You know, we do 100 retrospective chart reviews, and of those 100 retrospective chart reviews, we find one additional code. So that would say that, you know, the claims and the diagnosis codes and truly the risk that we're getting fed from that provider group is accurate. And we could say, oh, based on that information and the number of retrospective chart reviews that we did for you, your incentive payment is this. Or if you fall way below, then your kind of incentive is this. It was just something I was thinking in my head, and I didn't know if any plan had worked on that or discussed kind of approaching it in that way.
We're not doing that, but that's a great idea. That's something I'm going to take back and kind of look at my last big retro project data, kind of scroll through that. So thank you.
Yep.
This is Dean from Optima. I guess having worked at a for-profit, I'm so used to providers saying our goal is to improve coding. I'm sorry, payers saying our goal is to improve coding accuracy. That's what sounds nice when the real goal is to make as much money as possible. So I have to confess, I'm still looking at provider incentives that incentivize accurate but more thorough both documentation and coding. If you use the retrospective chart review or any other method to assess accuracy of coding and documentation by the doctor, I do feel those are two separate things.
Yeah, that's a good point.
This is Gina Paramount. We actually had one of the physicians in the organization make mention of that, that some of the things we wanted to see coded were not reimbursable to the physician, and so they were actually saying that at some point maybe we would think to open certain things up to pay where it hasn't happened yet, but that same conversation's come up here.
Hey there, this is Tim Poulton again, a physician from Asheville. I think I mentioned primary care. And when I'm talking to other providers about this, this is where people can get excited about the reasons for doing this, that the compensation structure, you know, is becoming different. And it will allow us to do things that provide better care for patients and make our providers, you know, clinical lives easier because you know, because the compensation model is different and it doesn't have to be tied to, you know, what counts in fee for service. So I really try to stress that to folks and they're receptive to it. And I start out just sort of highlighting that we're, you know, we're kind of, as one of my colleagues likes to say, standing with a foot in two floating canoes, and that's not a really stable place to be. But we are working to make that transition. So it's, you know, it's not always new this. But I think put in that context, people tend to be receptive and aren't so hung up on, you know, well, this is just to make money for the health system.
This is Brett Senor again. I'm Tim's colleague, and I wanted to piggyback on what he was saying. And you know, even outside of an incentive program like this, now we already do have skin in the game. And I think if you can really message it, and this is where Tim and I have had success, is just getting providers to understand that we do have skin in the game. You know, our performance is judged by our documentation, and we're only as good as what we document. And secondly, providers also really respond to patients benefit from this as well. You know, when we get it right, then there's resources available in the community for their care, kind of what Tim was alluding to. So I just wanted to add my two cents on that.
Awesome. Well, this has been really good discussion from this group today. I just want to let everybody know that we still have about 20 minutes left for our scheduled time for this discussion today. So are there any topics that maybe this group hasn't touched on today that you were really hoping to get some more information on, or something that we did talk about that you want to kind of bring back up and contribute another point to? We still have 20 more minutes to kind of share our feedback and insight on this topic.
This is Brett Senor yet again from Asheville. this is actually something that I was wondering if other people have come across this. And as we're building our program, one of the issues that arose was a misunderstanding, and apparently, and that is, you know, who is an eligible provider? And I think that we happen to experience a little bit of pain with the assumption that people that are doing annual wellness visits, for instance, a lot of times those are PharmDs. And when they submit data that ends up on a claim, it is not eligible for HCCs. And I think that people can be rather surprised when they find that, you know, something has been negated because it has been submitted by an ineligible provider. And I think we just really need to raise awareness of who are the eligible providers. And, you know, pay attention to that list as it changes and make sure you're educating everybody that is an eligible provider.
That's a really interesting point, Brett. This is Nicole with the Alliance. So when you guys are identifying those HCCs that are coming through from ineligible providers, are you guys doing something to then drive them back to an eligible provider? And what does that process maybe look like?
So, oh, are you asking Nicole? Please answer first, Nicole.
Oh, no, I was asking.
Oh, okay. You know, what we have done, and this is very early on, and you know, one of the things that we have suggested was maybe that the PharmDs can kind of tee up diagnoses for an eligible provider to then capture maybe at a later date. But just do not assume that those are HCC eligible.
Hi, could you just expand on that a little bit further? How would a PharmD tee that up?
it becomes a little bit of a challenge, you know, from a health plan perspective to really identify those providers. And number one, you know, there's going to be a delay. I think that I really can't tell you a great solution to this right now. And it's so early on in our own process that to be able to speak to how to mitigate that is a challenge. But the point that I was making was make sure that people are aware that not everybody that submits to claims are eligible providers to actually turn something into an HCC. So I wish that I could tell you that we had a strategy for that that is, you know, hard and fast. We're developing that.
Okay, great. Thank you. This is Nicole with the Alliance. Allison Dutton, are you on the call? Were you able to dial in?
I am on the call now, yes.
Awesome. Allison, you had made some comments on the discussion thread regarding your provider incentive programs and dashboards that you've created and reports that you've created. Based on the conversation you've heard today, do you have anything to add based on your experience with these provider incentive programs?
You know, our program is really pretty new, so we're really just starting to build it out. So it's been helpful for me to hear some of the comments, just for us to kind of learn some other approaches. You know, I think really we're, you know, since our program is new and our provider community isn't accustomed to HCC coding, we're being a little bit more generous in this first year in how we incentivize them. Essentially, we're providing them with all of the HCCs not yet documented, and when they send them back, as long as they provide the documentation or they let us know that those conditions aren't present, we are going to give them credit for that. We are going behind and auditing the charts to see if the coding guidelines have been met. However, if their documentation is insufficient, we're taking that as a teaching opportunity rather than penalizing them and not paying them for that particular instance. We're really just trying to get them engaged and paying attention, and we've had a good response in that sense in that, you know, we're able to say, you know, if they close all care gaps for an individual member for the year, they can receive $100. And it doesn't have to be that they document all the chronic conditions. They can let us know which conditions are no longer active to close those gaps.
That's great. Thank you, Allison. Is there anybody else on the call today who maybe has recently rolled out a provider incentive program that has some specific challenges they could share with the group that they encountered or specific successes that maybe haven't been shared yet today? All right. Well, while the group thinks about if they have any other questions they'd like to pose to the group or any other topics that this group might want to discuss in the last few minutes of our time together today, I did hear that a few of you have some resources that you're using with these incentive programs in while you're doing physician education, which might be helpful to share with this group so they can see what you're providing your providers. And one way you can do that is on the Health Plan Alliance website. So when you visit the website and you log in and then go visit the Member Resources tab, under the Knowledge Center, you have the ability to share resources. So if you have any resources that you think this group would find valuable, definitely go visit that section of the website and post and share those resources. And I think that would be really helpful for a lot of the individuals on this group to kind of see what you're doing and be able to use that as a reference for their programs as well. So, Jessica from Presbyterian, are you still on the line?
Yeah.
Awesome. Before we wrap up, do you feel like the discussion today helped address your initial question that you posed, or is there anything else you would like to pose to this group to see if they have any other feedback or insights?
Thanks for asking. Yeah, I mean, the discussion was definitely helpful. I was hoping for a little more success stories. But I did still get a lot of good conversation and ideas to go back with. I also just feel better because I was feeling, just to be honest, a little rushed to kind of come up with this metric. And I was trying to explain that it's not as cut and dry as everybody, you know, it sounds like, just give me an HCC metric. Like, it shouldn't be that difficult. And a lot of the concerns that I brought up, I appreciate that other health plans have those as well. So I'm not crazy. it is a program. It's a whole program to roll out, not just a metric, you know, and it's a whole kind of different way of thinking. And so I really appreciate it. And if anybody does try anything new and has any great successes and they can share, you know, and we'll do the same. Just thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Jessica. I'll pause for just one more time. We've got about 10 minutes left in the call, and I think Jessica made a great point with regards to those success stories. So if there are anybody else on the line who has, again, rolled out one of these provider incentive programs recently or has a program, a longstanding program that's been really successful, and maybe you have just a couple of nuggets of information you'd like to impart on the group before we end today's call, we'd love to hear from you. So feel free to chime in and if you have anything to share, we definitely have some time left and would love to hear from you. All right, I'm going to take that silence as nobody else has anything to add. Well, great discussion today, guys. This is very interesting. As Jessica said, lots of great takeaways from the conversation we had today. And as your provider incentive programs develop and you guys are finding stuff that works, share it on the discussion forum. I mean, that's how this call got started today, and we'd love to hear how those programs are evolving. Or if you have a case study you'd like to share, reach out to the Health Plan Alliance, and we will set up a webinar and get this group together again to highlight what worked and maybe readdress some of those challenges that are coming up as these programs evolve. So again, I just want to thank everybody for joining today's call. I know it was a little hairy. We had a lot of people on the call. At one point, I think we had over 50 people dialed in. So this is definitely a very hot and timely topic, and we really appreciate everybody participating and engaging in the discussion. And you guys have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you.